Jerry Rushford. I could, for many of you, he probably doesn't need an introduction. To some of you, I could read a long litany of things he's done, but he's a pretty humble guy, so I won't do that. However, I will tell you a story that he probably doesn't even know about. In September of 1978, there was a young man, a young 21-year-old man, that was a transfer student to Pepperdine University. This young man accumulated a pilot's license and 200 hours of flying, was working on his instrument rating, drove a little sports car, and had recently broken up with his girlfriend so that he could participate in the dating scene at Pepperdine. He was kind of a cocky young man on the surface. But the reality of what was going on with this guy is his mom had died 4 years before that. His father had kind of gone sideways in his life, and there were some things that happened in the church, and this young man was pretty disillusioned with the church and with God as well. Not sure exactly why he chose Pepperdine to go to, but in retrospect, I would suspect that God had his hand in that. Anyways, there was a young lady that this guy was interested in, and she would make a point to going to the Sunday service, which at that time was in a little auditorium there at Pepperdine. And so in order to make an impression on this young lady, this guy decided he would swallow his pride and go to church. And the preacher at that congregation was a man by the name of Jerry Rushford. He was a young man, and was kind of a little awkward looking, but his voice was mercurial, and he spoke from the Word of God, and somehow it touched this young man's heart again, to where he softened his anger towards God, and realized that he really needed God in his life, and I think this young man owes a debt of thanks to Mr. Rushford and the work and his commitment to the Lord. And Mr. Jerry Rushford.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good to be back with you. I was here 4 years ago. I'm sure you remember it. The opening Sunday of 2015. I think it was January 4. And I'm happy to say all of you look the same. You just don't age. I've been gone 4 years. Back at the Ventura Church, it's good to be with you. I was born and raised in Northeast Arkansas, and I grew up spiritually the first 4 years of my life in a little red brick Church of Christ that had two books behind the pew, like you have here. The black book was the Bible. It was the King James Version. Now you have the NIV. And it was a hymn book, and I was only, you know, birth to four. I'm pretty sure it was L.O. Sanderson's Christian Hymns, number one or two. And it was beige. But I still remember those two books, the black book and the beige book. Then my family moved to Detroit, Michigan, where I was raised, where I started kindergarten. And we went to the Strathmore Church of Christ. Again, we had the Bible there in the pew. And next to it, the hymn book was blue. We called it the Old Blue. It was Great Songs of the Church, number two. And between the age of 5 and I would say the age of 16, I memorized that hymnal. I could tell you any number in it, what hymn it was. Those were my two books. The Bible was authoritative. It was the Word of God. We spoke where the Bible spoke, and we were driven by it. We looked for a thus saith the Lord in all that we did. We were a very bibliocentric people. The Bible was our authority. But the hymn book, although it was not our authority, was a treasure filled with poetry and hymns and beautiful compositions of music. I have no gift for music at all. I couldn't do what Doug and the others did up here for anything. I'm a historian. It became obvious when I started college that my two loves were Bible and history. And it was sort of fated that I would be a church historian. But when I was in my senior year at Oklahoma Christian, And I was preaching for a little country church called Canadian out in the southeast corner between Eufaula and McAllister. I was preaching for this little church. And the November issue of the 20th Century Christian came out. I didn't see it, but when I went home for Christmas, my parents had it. And it was a series of hymn stories. And I never in my life realized that was possible. I came back from the Christmas holidays. It was January now, 1965, my senior year at Oklahoma Christian. I was getting ready to go out and preach at Canadian. And here were 11 hymn stories. Up until that time, I thought God said, let there be hymns. And let there be tunes for these hymns. And the Lord saw that it was good. It didn't occur to me that the hymns were written by human beings and that many of them were written out of great pain and loss. And I went out and I tried one of those hymn stories at the Canadian Church Christ, and I was a hero that morning. They loved that. And I was a hero for 11 weeks until I ran out of soap. I didn't have anything to lather with. I had never researched this. Since that time, I have never closed a sermon, and I'm getting close to preaching 60 years. I've never closed a sermon without the history of him. You know that. I've preached here several times. It's not that I disrespect the other book. Obviously, the Bible is the Word of God. But the hymn book is a treasure. And I have one purpose today. I want to say to you, we sing by rote too often. We just sing because we've sung all of our life, and we're not really thinking about the lyrics and what is being taught. So I asked, when Jim said, can you come on November 18th, I said, I'd like to preach through a hymn. So we've run the hymn off, and I'm telling you in advance what I'm going to do. I want to preach through this hymn. Everybody needs a copy. Is there anybody that does not have a copy now? Don't look over your shoulder at somebody else. You need your own copy. Everybody got a copy? Do we have more in the back if there are any hands? Here's the list. He's coming down the aisle now. Everybody raise your hand if you don't have your own copy. You're going to appreciate the lesson more if you don't have to look at the person next to you. You still got some more hands. Good. Now, have you ever been in a group of people in a living room somewhere where you get talking about your favorite hymn? And before long, you're saying it's not your favorite hymn. It's the greatest hymn ever written in the history of the world. And I've been in those situations. But what you're really doing there is saying, what hymn touches me emotionally the most? That's your favorite hymn. But that's not necessarily the greatest hymn of all time. I'm going to let you be my jury this morning. And I'm going to make the case that the hymn that I've run off here, I'm going to make the case that this very well could be the finest, the greatest hymn ever written in the English language. And then I will turn it over to you, the jury, at the end. It was written by Isaac Watts, and it was written somewhere before his first hymn book came out in 1707. Here's the backdrop. Isaac Watts was not from a family in the Church of England. He was a very brilliant young man, but he wasn't qualified to go to Oxford or Cambridge because he wasn't Anglican. There was a man in town who saw how brilliant he was, and he said, Isaac, I will pay your way to Oxford or Cambridge. I will pay your way. But you would have to become a member of the Church of England. But they were independent Christian people. In fact, later, the church that he preached for in London, on his tombstone, where I take people and we sing around his grave all the time, on his tombstone, he refers to it as a Church Christ. But he said no to his neighbor. I'm not interested in being a part of the Church of England, but thank you. And he went to school at a private school up north of London. He comes home in March of 1694, and he's 19 years old. And he lives with mom and dad for 30 months, 2.5 years. And he leaves when he's 22 years old. During those 30 months, he changes the world that you and I inhabit, the world of church-going people who love to sing. He is called with justification the father of the English hymn. What had we been singing for 1,000 years in the English language? Psalms. We had the songbook that Jesus had, the book of Psalms. There are 150 of them. Surely you don't need anything more. Just sing the book of Psalms for all of your life. The difficulty with that theory is that then you're not singing about Jesus. There are a few messianic references in the Psalms to the coming of the Christ, but all the great songs about Christ are not going to come out of the book of Psalms. And Isaac Watts is in that early stage when people were attempting to write hymns. And as you can imagine, the first people who tried it weren't very good. The hymn that really bothered young Isaac when he came home and went to church with his parents at the church building's not there anymore. There's a Marks and Spencer department store there now. And when I went around to the back of Marks and Spencer, there's a plaque there that says, Isaac Watts worshipped on this spot. And here's where he first sang hymns and wrote his hymns. So, well, the song I'm not going to sing it for you, which is the good news, but the song that they sang that morning went like this. A filthy dog I am by sin, a furious dog, dear Lord, I've been, a greedy dog in all my ways, and a dumb dog to all thy praise. Now, that's a lovely lyric. I don't know why. I don't know why Isaac didn't fall in love with that. If you'll forgive the pun, what I just quoted is doggerel. It's cheap poetry. It's not very good. And he came home and criticized it at lunch. I can remember doing that, criticizing something in front of my parents, and my dad would always say, do you think you can do better? Well, that day, Isaac Watts criticized what they had been singing, and his father, who was an elder in that church, Isaac Sr., said to him, don't you dare criticize the hymns of the church unless you can do better, young man, to his 19-year-old son, who said, Father, I can do better. And he went upstairs and began writing. That was at number 41 French Street. I go back there. House isn't there, but I know right where it was because I've looked at the old maps. I like to sit on the curb across from it. It's now a warehouse. And look at that warehouse at what was number 41 French Street and think of how much my life has been changed by what was written on that spot. He wrote 750 hymns that have secured his place as the father of the English hymn. And we love a lot, you know, we're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion, and so on. We're about to sing, you know, we're coming into the season where we'll sing Joy to the World, the Lord has come. I mean, Isaac Watts is all through the hymn book, and he has shaped us. But I think in the hymn we have here, we may have the most perfect hymn, and I'm using two categories to judge it. One, theology. Is this properly teaching the Bible? And number two, poetry. Is this man gifted? And he really is. When Samuel Johnson published his multi-volume set, The Lives of the Poets, what he considered the 52 greatest poets in the history of the English language, he included Isaac Watts. And some people criticized him and said, he's just a hymn writer. And the great Samuel Johnson said, he's more than a hymn writer. He's a gifted poet. So are we ready? Let's read through it, and then we'll sing it. And that'll be our lesson for today. When I survey the wondrous cross. He starts with an adverb. When you start with an adverb, you're in the middle of the story. He doesn't give you a moment to sort of feel your way into this hymn. It's there. He is suggesting this is not a one-time experience. I survey the cross a lot. And when I survey the wondrous cross, so when jumps us right in. And survey is the perfect word. He could have said, when I observe, when I look, when I consider. But survey is perfect. The dictionary says that it means to look at something from on high. But when we think of surveying something, sometimes we think of somebody down on their knees with a ruler and they're measuring it all the way around. Or you could be high on a mountain from the perspective of God and looking down and surveying the scene. And wondrous, isn't this a horrible instrument devised by human beings to torture people, to nail them on a piece of wood, and to call this wondrous? But God chose this instrument. God chose this instrument for the salvation of the world. Christ was the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. God chose this instrument. It is full of wonder. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died. Only he didn't write that. He wrote something else and he got criticized and he changed it. And my reaction is, leave this young man alone. Let him write. What he wrote was, when I survey the wondrous cross where the young Prince of Glory died. Where the young prince died. And his generation was offended that you would call Messiah young. How old was Christ when he died? 33? That seems young to me. I'm about to celebrate my 76th birthday. For those of you who were trying to figure it out when I told you when I was a senior in 1965. I remember coming to this room when I was 32, I think, or 33. Preaching. Bob Oliver asked me to come down and preach in a four-night meeting. I told for four nights, I gave history lessons on the history of Churches of Christ. And on the first night, Bob introduced me as a young preacher from Santa Barbara. I wasn't offended by that. I was young, 32, 33. I can't hardly even remember those days. That's how young I was. But his generation was offended. And so he changed it to on which the Prince of Glory died. Now, how many titles are there for Jesus in Scripture? If you take all the Old Testament and all the New Testament, this will be on the final exam in a moment. I'm a school teacher and I just have to, you know, hand out an exam. About 322 titles, give or take. But this one's never there, not in the King James Version. What is he doing here as a poet? He's using Isaiah 9:6, the Prince of Peace, which is always associated with the incarnation. You're going to get Christmas cards right away, talk about the Prince of Peace. All through the Christmas season, we'll talk about the Prince of Peace. And then you've got, what is it? Psalm 24:7, where it talks about the phrase that is used when Christ is coming into Jerusalem for the triumphal entry or the ascension back into heaven. King of glory. King of glory. You've got Prince of Peace, incarnation, King of glory, death, burial, and resurrection. But he gives us what? Prince of glory. He combines them. Is he doing this deliberate? I think so. Is he trying to say, I want to describe the entire earthly ministry of Jesus from the time he was born, the incarnation, till the time he went home to the right hand of the Father. The whole earthly ministry. And he can't do that with just Prince of Peace or King of Glory. So he gives us Prince of Glory. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, I do something. What do you do when you... We've just had the Lord's Supper. What do you do during that? When you're surveying the death of Christ, what are you doing? Here's what young Isaac Watts says he's doing. He gives us a financial term. Where did this come from? My richest gain, everything over here in my gain column, when I survey the cross, I take everything I've gained in life, all my trophies, all my newspaper articles, all the times people have applauded me, anything I've gained in life, but when I look at the cross, I take all those things I've gained and I put it over here in my loss column. Because I've realized when I look at the cross, these things that I've gained in life, whether it be money or power or prestige, or oftentimes they have separated me from Christ. So all the things I have gained, I put in loss. Whoa, I don't think I do that. He's not done. My richest gain I count but loss. And now he talks about the sin of pride, which is the basic sin. All sins come out of the sin of pride. And now he uses the English word contempt. If you were to try to describe contempt, and you were trying to just, you know, use it in some kind of language. What is contempt? Would you ever, in your wildest imagination, think of describing contempt as a liquid? I wouldn't. That would never have occurred to me. What kind of liquid is it? Maybe a thick motor oil? Maybe thicker than that. Picture a table that goes from this wall to that wall. And it's got these large buckets. And the buckets are filled to the very top, right to the brim, with contempt. And he's going to try to drown out his pride. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, but I do something else, and I pour, and I pour, and I lift bucket after bucket, and I pour this sludgy contempt on all my pride. He's trying to drown out his pride, but he can't do it. Pride is stubborn. I pour contempt on all my pride. End of verse 1. I'm tempted to stop right here and give it to you, the jury, and say this is the most remarkable hymn ever written in our beautiful language. But there is more. Verse 2, forbid it, Lord. Where's that coming from? The passage that was read. What does he have in front of him? Galatians 6:14 in the King James Version. And the King James says, forbid it, Lord, that I should glory save in the death of Christ my Lord. So he's got Galatians 6:14 open, and he's got a pad of paper, and he's writing, and he writes, forbid it, Lord, that I should boast. But that's not what the King James says. It says glory. And Watts thinks about using glory. What was in the reading you heard today from your NIV? Boast. Where did those translators get that idea from? The word's glory. They got it from Watts's hymn, is my guess. Boast is a much more invasive word. It's easy for us to say, oh, I don't glory in that. Well, do you ever boast? We all boast. It's part of the human psyche to boast. And now he writes, forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my Lord. He actually writes, Christ my God, showing the deity of Christ. This translation that I found and had run off, more of our hymnals probably say Lord. Either's fine. He said God. He's got 10 rhymes here. 9 of them are perfect. This is the only one that would be a false rhyme, because he wants the word blood, and that's why he goes with God. God, blood. It's a false rhyme. It's not an absolutely perfect poem. It's, you know, 1920s perfect. But he wanted blood in there at the end of that verse, and he goes with God. Lord is pretty much the same. Lord, blood, God, blood. It's not a perfect rhyme. Save in the death of Christ my Lord. All the vain things that charm me most. What are the vain things? What does John say they are in 2 John 2? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Vanity. And now he says, when I look at the cross, we're still looking back at verse 1. When I survey the cross, what do I do? He deals with the vain things in his life. And he uses a word that sounds so current, charm. That doesn't sound like an old word. That sounds like a modern word. Why do we sin? Because sin is charming. We sin because sin goes like this and says, Jerry, come here. You can do this. You know you want to do this. Your whole culture is doing it. Why shouldn't you do it? Sin is charming. Watts knows this. All the vain things, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, all the vain things that charm me most, I say to God, I'm not going to do these again. Isn't that what you would say? Isn't that what I've said? Wouldn't God be satisfied with that? If I said, God, all these vanities, I'm not going to do these anymore. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. But that's not what Watts says. I can't believe this. He doesn't say, I'm not going to do this anymore. He says, I'm going to kill them. I'm going to put them away. I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to sacrifice them to the blood of Christ. Whew. Whoa. This hymn is taking on a little different. This is a little overwhelming. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his blood. The blood is the sacrifice. Christ is giving his blood to say, he's sacrificing his blood for us. But now he turns it around. Watts says, I'm going to sacrifice all the vanities to the blood of Christ. It's his way of saying, because the blood of Christ was shed for me, I sacrifice all the vain things in life to that blood that washes me and cleanses me. What a concept. How many words in this poem? 139. How many are monosyllables? 120. Very easy to understand. The great poets can pull this off using simple words. Only 17 times does he use a two-syllable word like survey or wondrous. And only twice in the entire five verses does he use three syllables. And one is right here, sacrifice, the perfect word. And he comes back in verse 5 with amazing, which is the key to the end. But other than those two exceptions, monosyllables and very simple words. Now we've gone through two verses. Now we're ready for the horror of the death of Christ. And the next two verses are hard to read. They're hard to contemplate. They're overwhelming. He starts with the word see. That's interesting, which is a way of saying, pay attention. I'm getting ready to paint you a picture. See? See what? He's looking at Christ on the cross. But what he's interested in is the death of Christ. He doesn't use the word Christ in the entire hymn after the first line, when I survey the wondrous cross. He doesn't use cross. Did I say Christ? He doesn't use cross again. Now he's focusing on the death of Christ. And how is he looking at Christ? From the top to the bottom. Christ is being scourged, you know, by Pilate, and they say, you say you're a king. You don't look like a king. Boys, does he look like a king to you? A king ought to have a crown. Go down by the riverbank, guys, and get him some of those long-branched briars, those thorny ones. And they bring it up, these thorns, and they twist it into a crude crown, and they crush it onto his head so that it lacerates his scalp and the blood mingles with their spit because they've been spitting on him. Now you look more like a king, Jesus. But a king ought to have a robe. Go get one of my robes, boys. And they come back and they throw the robe around it. And a king ought to have a scepter. And they say, what could we use as a scepter? Go down by the riverbank and pull some of those reeds. A reed is like a wet noodle. This is sarcasm. And they put the wet noodle in his hand. Now you look more like a king, Jesus. You got you a crown, got you a robe, got your scepter. Now Watts is looking at this scene on the cross. And he says, see from his head, the lacerated scalp, his hands nailed to the cross, his feet nailed. See from his head, his hands and feet, blood and water flow mingled down. Is that what it says? What does John 19:34 say? Pilate receives word that we need to hasten the crucifixion. We need to get these men dead. So he sends the order to break their legs. Why would that kill somebody? Because you are involuntarily pushing your body up to breathe when you're being crucified. But if the legs are broken, now you can't do that. You're going to sag and die much quicker, probably, you know, because of lungs and asphyxiation. And they go to the thief on the right and the thief on the left, right? And they break their legs, and now they come to Jesus, and he's already dead. This doesn't seem possible. And one soldier is not sure. He's staring at him. And what does he do in John 19? He takes out his sword or his saber. He takes out a sharp instrument, his spear. And he, according to 19:34, he thrusts it into the side of Jesus. There's evidently no cry, no whelp. He's dead. But out flows, John 19:34, blood and water to show that he is dead. And the water content of the blood has already begun to separate. Now, does Isaac Watts not know his Bible? Oh, I think we're far enough into this hymn to say he knows his Bible very well. But why doesn't he give us blood and water? That's biblical. He does not give us blood and water. He gives us their spiritual equivalents. He's a poet. He's trying to help us. He doesn't give us blood and water. He gives us their spiritual equivalents. Sorrow and love. This is the heart of the whole hymn. Miss this and you miss everything. Sorrow and love. Sorrow for sin and love for the sinner. Christ is not sorrowful for his own death. He is sorry that the sins of human beings have separated them from their Creator. That's what he's sorry for. And as Paul says in the Roman letter, Christ died for us while we were still in our sins. The love of the sinner. Sorrow for sin and love for the sinner. He's still looking from top to bottom, right? Here's the scene. See from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled. Mingled, flow, mingled. Sorrow and love flow mingled down. And now he asks a question. I would have never thought to ask this question. What a question. He asks this question. Has this ever happened before? And it's pretty obvious that for him the answer is no. Never in the history of our planet has this kind of sorrow, sorrow for sin, and this kind of love, love for the sinner, rendezvoused, gotten together, hung out together. Flow mingled down together. He says in his question, did e'er such love and sorrow meet? Did they ever meet? Not until this moment when Christ dies for the world. The most dramatic moment in the history of our world. He says it's never happened before. Or thorns, he says. Did thorns ever compose so rich a crown? There's so much in that word compose, composition. I plead that I can't figure it all out. It's just part of the mind of Isaac Watts. Now comes the verse you've never sung. My name is in the front of this hymnal. I'm proud of it. You know, we put this out. It's a good hymnal, and I'm happy to have my name associated with it. But I lost the vote. I'm doing all five verses of this hymn. It's on page 315, and I'm embarrassed to say page 315 goes 1, 2, 3, and 5. So why don't we sing 4? Even when Watts wrote it, it was criticized. And his first hymnal was 1707. When he came out with his next hymnal in 1709, just 2 years later, he put verse 4 in brackets. He put brackets all the way around it, and he said, you can omit this verse without harming the sense of the hymn. He gave in to his culture. I don't agree with what he said. I don't think you can admit it without harming the hymn. I'll show you in a moment one key word that makes no sense. I think we ought to sing all five verses, and today we are singing. Now, there are some Church of Christ hymnals that have all five. Praise for the Lord, John Wiegand's hymnal that comes out of 21st Century Christian in Nashville, that has all five. And my friend James Tackett, who put together the paperless hymnal, is that what you use? The paperless hymnal has got all five verses. But we sing 1, 2, 3, and 5. And why was it taken out? It wasn't taken out until George Whitfield did it. And all the books, I've read them all, they all say in 1757. But I went back and looked at that hymnal. He didn't take it. That must be a typo. I don't see it until 10 years later. 1767. When were the words written? The hymn book came out in 1707. At the very least, 60 years later, two generations later, finally, they take Isaac Watts up on what he said. You can omit four if you want to. And we started omitting it. We've been omitting it for centuries now. Why was it omitted? Because it's gruesome. Let's read it. His dying crimson. It's not dying crimson. It's coagulated blood, and it's not a pretty sight. His dying crimson, like a robe, spreads o'er his body on the tree. Is Watts thinking of the robe that Pilate told them to put around, or Herod, that was Herod Antipas, that Herod told his people to put around him? Is he thinking of that? I don't know. Is he just looking for a word that rhymes with globe? Maybe. He's a poet. But that's too easy, and nothing Watts does is easy. I wear a big robe. My robe comes up here to my chin. I had it on this morning to go out and get the paper. My wife said, go get the paper. And the robe touches the floor. I just don't like any, I don't like to be encumbered by my robe. It's big. He says, his dying crimson like a robe spreads o'er his body on the tree. It's not a tree, it's a cross, but he's a poet. He's helping us here. Then, what does then refer to? Nothing in this verse. Verse 3? No. Verse 2? No. It goes back to that adverb that we started the poetry with. When I survey the wondrous cross, in those moments when I'm surveying the cross, in verse 4 he says, then am I dead to all the globe. And all the globe is dead to me when I'm really reflecting on the cross. We lose that when we take out the fourth verse. Then am I dead to all the globe, and all the globe is dead to me. Why does he say globe? You know, the easy answer is it rhymes with robe. But I have a feeling. I mean, what did Galatians 6:14 say that was just read to you? It said world, didn't say globe. I'm crucified to the world, and the world is crucified to me, Galatians 6:14. He says globe. I think Watts lives so much closer to that time in history when we discovered we were living on a globe and that the world was not flat. That globe was a more profound term for him than world. That's just my guess. But you're right, it does rhyme with robe. And maybe that's why he used it. Okay, we're ready for the last verse. And I want to open by saying, I am not equal to this. I'll do the best I can. But the last verse is the greatest verse ever written in any hymn in the history of the English language. And I just am in awe of it. And so let's read it, and then we're going to sing these five, and we'll be done. Were the whole realm of nature mine? Have you noticed how personal everything is here? Four times he used the word I, when I survey the wonders of it. Forbid it that I should boast. Nobody had ever done that before. Watts is given credit for putting himself into the hymn. And you and I are singing it, and so we put ourselves into it. I, me, my. Were the whole realm of nature mine? Which, by the way, it isn't. So he's playing with us here. He's trying to get us to use our imagination. So are you willing to play for 1 minute? We'll just play for 1 minute. Okay, here's how the game goes. The whole realm of nature belongs to Jerry Rushford. Yosemite National Park, that's mine. Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, those are mine. Lori and I traveled in New England in early October, these forested states all ablaze with color. That's all mine. All of New England. All of the constellations of the stars. All of the planets. It's all mine. And I take all the realm of nature and I offer it to the Creator God in exchange for my sins. And this young Isaac Watts dares to say to me, Jerry, that is a present far, 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 far too small. And I have to sit down at that for a moment. I have just offered God the whole realm of nature, and you're telling me that's too small? Why is that too small? Because God does not require the whole realm of nature. That's not what God wants. What He wants is me. My heart. And that's the last thing I'll let go of. I'll give Him all my possessions before I'll give Him me. I'll give Him my family before I'll let go of me, my heart. Were the whole realm of nature mine? That were a present far too small. Here's the finale. The key word, of course, we knew it was coming, is love. This was all about God's love for His children and Christ is sent to die for the sins of the world. How do you describe this love? Watts thinks about it, it's going to take a three-syllable word. He doesn't like, he likes to stay with one syllable, but it's going to take a three-syllable, not just like love. And he comes up with an interesting word, amazing. Now, we love to sing Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. How many years ahead of John Newton writing Amazing Grace? John Newton writes that on December 31, 1772, to be sung the next day at the New Year's ceremony at the church in Olney, England. So, and Watts is writing this in the late 1690s or early. So 75 years before John Newton writes Amazing Grace, Isaac Watts is saying, that word amazing is a pretty powerful word. I'm going to use it here. Love, so amazing. But he needs one more word. So, and he can't think. Love, so amazing, so, because it's otherworldly. Love, so amazing, so, so divine. He comes up with it. Divine. It's something out of this world, this love of God on a cross. Love, so amazing, so divine, demands. Did you see the three-point outline? I mean, every great poem, every great hymn, three-point outline. When you survey the wondrous cross, it tells you, number one, what it forbids. Number two, what it reveals. And number three, what it demands. There's the outline of this morning's lesson. When you survey the cross, what does it forbid? Boasting. You can't boast of your salvation. Boasting is out the window. We were never good at it. Let's don't do it anymore. Boasting is off the table. Number two, it reveals the heart of the gospel. What is that? Sorrow and love flow mingled down. Sorrow for sin, love for the sinner. And now at the end, what does it demand? And it's right there in front of you. My soul, that's everything I am, my soul. Demands my soul. My life, that's everything I do, my work, my energy, how I spend my time. My soul, my life, my all. That's everything I have. That's all God demands. It's not much. He doesn't want the whole realm of nature, not that it's yours to give, but He wants you, and He wants your soul. He wants your life. He wants everything. That's what surveying the cross will do. Demands my soul, my life, my all. Now here's how we will sing it. Growing up in Detroit, Michigan, we never sang verse 3 with the lights on. I never questioned that. I was 5 when we moved up there. Never once did I look over my shoulder and see who was turning those switches off. Probably Andy Miller or Don Smith, or maybe my dad, one of the deacons. I never looked. I just knew how appropriate it was. So Jim, should I do the ones up here in the front when you're doing the back? Two sides, I see them both. So we're going to, Doug's going to lead us, and we're going to remain seated. And the first two verses, we're going to sing full-throated, normal volume. Just belt it out. Then we're going to pause, because now we're getting ready to look deep at the death of Christ. We'll pause for a moment, and we're going to dim the lights. It's not going to make much difference in here. But verses 3 and 4, we're going to sing very softly, meditatively, very soft. Then we're going to pause again before verse 5, because verse 5 is where we all stand. And the light switches come back on, and we sing verse 5 if we truly believe it. Like this is the greatest truth we have ever known, and we're the whole realm of nature and mind, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. We're going to belt that out. We'll use it as a song of invitation. This would be a great day to be baptized into Christ. If you have a need for the prayers of the church, if you're new in this community and you'd like to identify with this church, we'll use it as a song of encouragement. But it's a song for every one of us. And on that fifth verse, we're going to stand and belt that out. So let's remain seated, and let's sing verses 1 and 2 as Doug leads us.